गुरवे गौरचंद्राय राधिकाय तदालय कृष्णाय कृष्णभक्ताय तद्भक्ताय नमो नमः। ॐ पूर्णामदः पूर्णामिदं पूर्णात् पूर्णामुदच्यते पूर्णस्य पूर्णमादाय पूर्णमेवावशिष्यते। Pranam. Welcome to all. Greetings from England. So we are having a very interesting dynamics today. As you can see, we have part of our retreat group in the UK under the name of Bhakti Rasa. Bhakti Rasa has expanded in the form of many more. We are witnessing the universal form of Bhakti Rasa. And I could be with all of them in the floor downstairs, but I chose to be a little bit more quiet in this room so I can also look at you in the screen. I have looked at all these other beautiful people all these days, and I will continue to do so, guys. Nothing personal, just trying to share the reciprocity and presence and attention with everyone. So, yeah, we are in the midst of our UK retreat, reaching its last days. We have been sharing some of the lectures. We won't be sharing all of them in a row because we don't want to overwhelm you sharing almost like 15 lectures in 1 week. So I'm sharing those after every 2 or 3 days. But yeah, we are having a very special time together. Lots of sharing, lots of epiphany, aha moments, aho moments. So very happy and very blessed to be with them, but to be with all of you today as well. Thank you so much for connecting to our weekly satsang, trying to bear witness to the unfolding of our journey in each one of us in the most radically personal way possible. So, as you know, you are all more than invited to bring any offering you may have, any question, any sharing. And you can do so by raising your digital hand if you can. That will be the ideal way. And we will try to address whatever sharing, contributions, questions, quests, explorations you may have, and trying to explore it all together today. So I'm seeing one hand raised from quote unquote Bhakti Rasa, though I'm seeing a bunch of people over there. So who is the one? That's Jamuna raising her two hands, non-digital hands. So maybe we can, yeah, turn on the microphone. Let's see if we can hear Jamuna or she has to be closer. We'll see.
Can you hear me?
Maybe you can get a little closer if possible.
Okay.
Sorry. Yeah.
Do I look here?
Yeah. Even talk a little louder if possible. Still, you are not that close.
So in life we go through so many different stages. Stages of responsibility, stages of growth. So, we all have our background of different samskaras, and some are positive and some are negative. And so, as we grow, how to be a positive influence on helping others grow, how to reach across to others to help them grow in a positive way. How to grow into our boots in a healthy way in helping and bringing others up to their potential. An elder, so to speak. I'm not saying I'm an elder, but an elder, that type of
Yeah.
mood. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that, thank you. So, can share some thoughts about that. Of course, I recall in terms of elderhood, what it means to be an elder, the importance of having elders in our tribe, in our village, in our tradition, our family. Elders are always very, very crucial figures. And as I try to make it clear at the end of Radical Personalism, there is a whole section in, I think it's the conclusion of the book, on elders. And as I like to also remind myself to begin with, that elder age doesn't make one an elder. The passing of years doesn't make one an elder. Even being in a particular religious movement for a certain number of years doesn't make you an elder necessarily. Because elderhood is not olderhood. No, it's just one letter, but it makes a whole difference. We can grow older, but growing elder, that's a different way. Growing wise, growing sage, learning from your experience. We all have experiences, but to become an experienced person means you are learning from your experiences in a way that keeps you always in a very humble, teachable space. And those who are real elders, to be honest, they don't consider themselves as such. In their inner core, their main identities, I'm a servant, I'm a student forever, like Srila Siddhar Maharaj, an elder par excellence, will say. Of course, they may take in that role, they may guide and help others in service, but again, the main identity is I'm a servant, I'm a student, I'm a learner perpetually. And for me, a very clear, though many of us may not see that clearly, and I did for a long time, but at one point, the simple fact that Shukadev Goswami is the main guru in the Srimad Bhagavatam, main guru figure, in one sense, the guru of Parikshit Maharaj. And he's not an elder in the usual way we tend to think about elders, right? He's a 16-year-old naked boy. And he's a guru of the Bhagavatam to the point that his own father and guru Vyasadeva and his own father's guru, Srila Narada Muni, are there listening to him. So the Bhagavatam gives us a very, how to say, outside of the box notion of what it means to be an elder. Here you have a 16-year-old naked boy sitting in the Vyasasana and instructing not only the world's emperor, Parikshit Maharaj, who by age is older, and you could say he has more experience in the world, but on top of that, his own father and guru Vyasadeva is sitting, rapt attention, listening to the katha. His own father's guru, Srila Narada Muni, is sitting in the front row, fastening his seat belts, because he knows here we are about to have something very, very intense, very deep. And that's the very interesting image of an elder that the Bhagavatam is given, very unexpected one. Just to, among other things, to send a message, don't take for granted that because you are old, you are an elder. Someone can be 15 years old and be an elder. Mystical Christians will consider Jesus a wise elder, and he was 33. And by contrast, many times we can, because someone might think, well, as you know, how many times we have heard this question, but he has been practicing Krishna consciousness for 50 years. But that doesn't warranty anything. Because if you have been practicing for 50 years for the wrong reasons, the more years that pass, the worse. Right? To give you an example, okay, I have been chanting for 50 years. I mean, I'm giving an example. I don't even have 50 years myself, but if I got accustomed to chant while watching movies, on year one, that was my standard, and that continued for 50 years. The more years pass through that quote unquote chanting, the worse. So the more years I mention as a credential, if I'm not doing things from the right place and for the proper reasons, the worse in one sense. No? So I think that's very important. And I'm saying that to myself to begin with, because it's so easy to buy into the senior devoted trip, so to say. And you can, and as we were talking the other day, pride is so resourceful. Pride is very resourceful. You can be proud about anything, right? I don't know. I've started bhakti at one day, and you came to the temple 2 weeks after. I'm senior than you for 2 weeks. You should look upon me because I'm 2 weeks elder. It's ridiculous, right? Of course, when they think the numbers get bigger, that becomes even more complicated. Because now I've been practicing for 25 years. And not only that, I'm Swami Padmanabha. What do you think about that? Right? I'm kind of dramatizing, you know, how the secret voice may try to come, right? Like, already you have been practicing for 25 years. Wow. Almost 10 years as a brahmachari, more than 15 years as a sannyasi. You have not broken the vows. Here you are. You are such an elder, such a senior devotee. All that stuff can come. And it's ridiculous. It's absolutely contradictory to the essential spirit of what we are supposed to be doing here. So I'm saying all this in case you feel that I'm coming at any point with my credentials in front of you. Please humble me. Remind me, Maharaj, you are not your credentials. That's the very definition of bhakti. Sarva upadhi vinirmuktam. Get absolutely rid of all designations. I'm a senior devotee. That's a designation. You have to die to that. I'm a Prabhupada disciple. Great, all glories to that. But we shouldn't weaponize that as a credential to look for prestige, fame. I'm a disciple of such. I'm a disciple of such. Again, I have not no problem with anyone being a disciple of anyone. It's fine. But how we are being a disciple of whomever. To begin with, those things should be very personal and private, right? So we shouldn't be. Gopayet Guru Ratmana. Hide your guru. Hide your discipleship. Keep it very private, very confidential. Elaborate your offerings in the depth of your heart. So those are the examples that we receive from our great teachers. Again, Bhagavatam's notion of elderhood is very counterintuitive. You don't think of a 15-year-old boy as an elder. And then you have other quote-unquote elders from the Bhagavatam, big guys, so to say, like Indra and Brahma, and doing lots of mistakes at times. Now, it doesn't mean that we do not respect them, but just to shake our notions, to invite us to deconstruct wrong ideas and not to fall into the trap of certainty, complacency. I'm elder, I'm Maharaj, I'm guru, I'm practicing 2 decades, 3 decades, for whatever. Each one can bring their own cards, their own credentials. I'm doing this, I've given this donation, I've opened this number of temples, I published this number of books, I've learned this many melodies of Maha Mantra for whatever. No. All of those things are perfectly fine as long as you are not boasting, you say? Boasting about that. Because if not, we are missing the point. We are missing the mark. Any of those things were there to create a persona for us, to make us more special than others, to make ourselves feel entitled. No? There is this word in English that is very interesting. We don't have that in Spanish, if I can think of, which is entitlement, right? We feel that we are superior by whatever. Because I'm a man, because I'm a woman, because I'm white, because I'm green, because I'm blue, because I'm saffron, because I'm. And we are missing again the core instruction of Mahaprabhu. Look at the grass and be humble. Now stop all the other stuff, right? So a real elder is someone who is who is never thinking about resorting to his or her credentials to make a living or to make a persona or to try to impress others, to try to impose yourself onto others, to try to push down others. What to speak of that? Unfortunately, sometimes that happens in any religious or social circle. Unfortunately, we sometimes use we are suffering from a superiority complex, and we end up discouraging other people discouraging people from exploring their potential, exploring their creativity, thinking critically, because we think we know best. Even if we know best, especially if you know best, knowing best gives you the maturity to explore how other people are thinking. No? Because if knowing best takes you to a place of overt certainty where you are absolutely sure that you know best than the other person who is younger than you, junior than you, that starts to, how to say, to show that you do not know best. So a true elder is willing to learn from others, is willing to empower others, is willing to be open to what other people's potential is, and try to, if this that comes from a sincere place, from an honest place, to allow that to happen. Even if allowing that to happen may carry potential risks, no? Like a parent with a child, no? A father and mother may be afraid, oh, if I allow my child to be free to do what he or she wants to do, she may do a mistake and I know best. I've grown up, so I will tell her how to think and what to do. But if you do that on an absolute level, you are basically canceling that person. You are spoiling that person's growth. So at one point, you have to allow them to explore their potential. And that will be empowering for the children. Even if you as a father know, oh, he doesn't know what he's doing, how he's thinking, how he's talking. He's 5 years old, 15 years old. I've gone through that. I know what's the real deal. So what do you will do, right? You will live the other person's life. Yourself is not possible. You will try them to think like yourself. That's not possible either. Right? So that's a very interesting line, no, to navigate. Yeah, the other day I was talking to one of the friends that came to visit us, and his age was, I think, 23. So, I mean, he could be my son. Of course, I'm a sannyasi, so that's not an option, so to say. But in terms of age, he could be it could be his young father or an elder brother. And you see someone at that age, and somehow you see yourself at that age, you see yourself reflected in what they are struggling and navigating with their own unique nuance, but you cannot avoid seeing yourself, but you have to stop that at one point, because if not, it becomes everything about you and everything about how you navigated that and what you think and what the other should do, and it becomes too self-centered. So it's a very interesting exercise to witness that and to listen to the younger generations. Again, that's a big symptom of an elder. An elder is not only a figure that is teaching the rest of the community, but is someone who is very willing to learn from younger voices, from everyone, including youngers, no? And to empower them in to explore their own creativity with their own tools, with their own ways of thinking, which may escape the elders. No, again, the way that is someone, if I get to be 60 or 70 at one point, and I'm talking with someone from with this which who is 20, I may not be able to fully grasp their universe. I may try my best to be empathic and accompany that journey, but there is certain things that I cannot grasp, and I have to, if they are sincere, I have to trust them, and I have to let it go as an elder, and not trying like to warranty that they are doing things exactly like it should be, so it's correct and proper, because big part of being an elder is also letting go. That's how an elder teaches in so many ways. And you have to let go more and more the more you get close to your final breath in this body. Because in that final breath, you really need to let go of basically everything in one sense. So that's a very humbling exercise. That's how the cycles of life are made, right? No, when you are getting into the antelila, so to say, into the last period of your journey, so many things start to crumble and collapse. Body, memory, so many things. And you need to learn to let go, not to hold on, to grab, And it can feel humiliating. It can feel a form of defeat, but it's a form of surrender. And it's glorious if it's embraced properly. And it's a great testimony to the younger generations, like an elder will can leave behind, learning from the younger ones, releasing, letting go, accepting, surrendering. That's, of course, that takes a lifetime of preparation generally. So I think that's very important, and I've seen that in many movements and in many groups, many times communal growth is prevented because, unfortunately, let's be honest, and I've talked that with many, and I'm not pointing here to anyone, it's just a principle. But many times the people who are supposed to be the elders are not that elder. They are just older. But if you are not old and you are humble enough, realized enough, dynamic enough, willing to having trained your inner muscle to release certainty, to release ways of thinking, to embrace new ways of thinking, to embrace new versions of yourself, of others. If that muscle is stifled, like stagnant, the less you use it, eventually it may become quite unbecoming. If you are in a position of leadership and you don't have that openness to learn, to change, to grow, to trust, again, it's a big, and I'm talking for myself also, it's a big challenge to trust new ways of doing things, new voices, new ways of thinking, because many times the tendency is we go to what's familiar and we tend to build an identity around that. Even if the identity is painfully dysfunctional, even if the identity has not served us well for decades, at least it's an identity, we may think. It's what I have. If I don't have that, I have no identity, and that's even worse. So sometimes we cling into certain ways of doing and thinking and seeing ourselves and seeing others because somehow that reinforces a sense of being. And we may be unconsciously afraid or even terrified of letting that go. And what will come from that? Will I still be alive? Will I still exist? Will I be accepted, loved, whatever, no? So a real elder is a very courageous person who is willing to undergo those fires of trial over and over again, many times, once over and over. And that's how an elder teaches by example. So, yeah, I think it's very, very inspiring, very encouraging, and very challenging for all of us because somehow or other, we are all, most of us, I will say, are elders to, are, or are supposed to be elders to someone else. At least if you speak in terms of age, most of us are not 1 year old, 5 years old, 10 years old. So generally, in one way or another, we end up having people under our care, where they are sons, daughters, students, whatever. So there is a role to play in that sense. And it's important that each of us can ask ourselves sincerely, what's my role to play here and how I'm doing about that and what can I do to increase that? As I remember also mentioning in radical personalism, and I'll try to conclude with that because it can go forever. Also, an important role of an elder is that they have the capacity to hold themselves accountable and to acknowledge their mistakes. It's not that because now you're elder, nobody can hold you accountable, and you're expected to be perfect. So therefore, if you make a mistake, better don't say it because you're an elder now. A part of being an elder is acknowledging in an elderly way, with wisdom, humility, and openness, when you have fallen short of your ideal, of the best version of yourself. And it's very nourishing for the rest of the community to see an elder holding himself, herself accountable. It's normalizing that pattern, giving the younger ones an example of, oh, this is okay, you can do it also. It's part of the journey. Is dignifying in its own way. It's humbling. So yeah, it's an important point to make. And I know it sounds very simple, But somehow or other, at least some of us may have received another idea about what's an elder. And sometimes those ideas are so ingrained that even unconsciously we may act them out ourselves. And we may end up talking to people as we know better and telling them what to do and not to do and distrusting their own new ideas. And instead of encouraging, discouraging, and again, without any bad intention, just unconsciously playing out the narrative that we may have imbibed after a few decades of what it means to be an elder. And I think it's healthy to, again, a real elder. One aspect of being an elder is that an elder is willing to constantly question what it means to be an elder. Right? Well, if you are seen as an elder, you will be on a daily basis asking what it means to be an elder today, for me, to others, what it means to be an elder. No, not easy answers, not fixed conclusive statements, not absolute formula. This is an elder. Whomever fits the box, you are branded as such. Welcome to the elderly tribe. And you don't have to do anything. Just you need to grow old, you're an elder. No. On the contrary, a real elder is not growing old. Like a teacher of mine will say, you start growing old when you stop learning. So you start to get older, not elder, when you stop learning. In other words, a real elder continues to learn from everyone. Yeah. So I think it's a sobering thing for all of us again to how in my elderhood project, in my attempt to guide others, be a reference point for others in one way or another, how to do so in a way that is facilitating their growth, facilitating their potential, not allowing anything and everything, of course. Sometimes we need to put boundaries and have caution and present our doubts and ideas, but to do so in a way that we are really nourishing potential around us. It's an elder has to be an empowering entity, not a disempowering unit that whenever the elder goes, everyone becomes discouraged. That's not the idea. There comes the elder and everyone gets scared and nervous and starts to freak out. Oh my gosh, another time the elder is coming. Nobody will should feel like that if you're a genuine elder. The whole village will be celebrating. A real elder's presence is very organic, very natural, very humble, very unassuming. And I'm not saying all this because I am an elder and I know what it means to be an elder. But I've been with elders and you can see how those things are brimming very organically from them. An elder, again, is not acting out elderhood, right? It's not like, okay, now I'm an elder. Oh, now come the young ones. I'm supposed to be an elder. It's just they are who they are. Finally, they are who they are. They got to that point that where they are okay being who they are. And that in itself is such a teaching. When you can witness someone being okay being who they are, embracing their potential with honesty, integrity, humility, wisdom, gratitude, generosity, that's such a gift for all our faculties to witness. So I don't know, Jamona, some ideas. I don't know if that helps, if you have any further reflections or thoughts or something you may like to add.
Yeah, just on reflection, in being honest and vulnerable, which is what the retreat has been and brought out in me, it's what you've said is a beautiful roadmap because in my personal experience, my own personal experience, is that an elder has stopped me from growing. They don't encourage me to grow. They don't give it's, I'm here, doesn't matter how many years or how much practice I've done in spiritual life, whatever quality that may or may not be, I will never be able to grow up. I will never be given the space to grow up. So you've given a wonderful roadmap to not actually pass on what I have received and what I still work to not absorb from others. So, thank you.
And of course, and you know that we've been talking about that these days. Even if for whatever reason we have had some not so ideal, at times at least, examples of what it means to be an elder, whether it's in a spiritual tradition, at home, family here and there, teachers at school, we should also see all that with compassion and understanding, right? So as to not repeat the cycle and understand, not to justify the unjustifiable, but just probably to know they are passing whatever they can pass according to the toolkit they have, and they may have their own lackings in their own experiences with some other elders. So trying to always invoke the bigger picture to the point that we end up in a on a note of compassion and understanding, not on hate, bitterness, resentfulness, cynicism, and we make the snowball even bigger and the problem even graver. So we can really start a healing project and break this vicious cycle and begin anew, so to say, in that sense. So, yeah. Thank you. Thank you. So let's go to our breakout rooms, breakthrough rooms. Those who are there literally in 3D, which are like 15 or something, you will organize yourself in groups. But those who are online connected, many of you today, we invite you to share maybe like 6, 7 minutes. A little bit about any thoughts and reflections you may have among yourself, but the rest will create these groups, about 3 people each, and continue sharing and churning with one another, listening, bearing witness to each other, opening your heart, sharing thoughts about elderhood, how to embody that ourselves, how to approach, look for those qualities in other, what it means, whatever you feel inspired to share, and see you in a few minutes back. Concise, nice, concise, intense sharing period altogether. I hope you have had that. So we'll continue with anything you may like to bring to the table. I'm seeing that Bhakti Rasa still has her hand raised, Rasangi as well. We'll get to you, Rasangi. But who is raising her hand there in the name of Bhakti Rasa? It seems Swetadvip Radhika. Okay. If you can get as close as you can to the screen, that will be great because we will be able to listen better.
Okay, is that
Yeah, good.
okay? Okay, let me see if if I can articulate this properly. It's kind of jumbled in my head. So I was thinking of how, like, in our tradition, like Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, there's quite an emphasis on going to the spiritual world, like the goal being prema bhakti, and then, like, thinking about eternal service in the spiritual world in Goloka Vrindavan. And I was thinking, like, just a little bit that I have learned about Christianity, somehow it seems like there is quite an emphasis on connecting with the suffering of the world, suffering in the world. Kind of like, I think taking on from the example of Jesus, saying like Jesus suffered for the people or something like that, and they kind of try to connect with that. So even if somebody, like, is very realized and gets in touch with God, still, like, their purpose is to connect with the suffering and help, like, to serve in this world. Maybe even that, like, continue to come back and, like, serve, something like that. I mean, I'm not saying that it's not present in our tradition. Definitely we do have examples where, who is that, Vrindavan Das Thakur, who was saying that, like, take everybody and, like,
Vasudev, Vasudev Datta.
sorry. Yeah, but somehow it still seems like there's quite an emphasis on going to the spiritual world and, like, having an eternal service there. And it is very, very, like, appealing, and I myself kind of feel like, oh, that's nice, and it seems scary to be able to, like, yeah, I mean, the idea of always being here and, like, just dealing with connecting with the suffering and helping, although the thought seems really very nice. I'm not there yet, neither of the places, but just I was thinking, is there really, like, a difference like that, or just my understanding? although we see like a lot of similarities between like Christianity and the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, I'm thinking, is there really a difference in terms of like the long term, like, vision? Or, yeah.
Yeah,
Yeah,
thank you.
That's clear.
Yeah, I would say to begin with that when we say the Christian vision and the Gaudiya Vaishnava vision, there are so many visions among each one of those traditions, right? You will find many devotees who are very much afterlife oriented, right? Like mukti oriented, while we officially in principle will say liberation is not our goal. Many of them are, or when we, even if we say divine love is our goal, for many divine love is something that happens after you get liberated. So that happens somewhere else at some point in the future. So even our talk on prema bhakti, our talk on divine love can be mukti oriented rather than being something that is waiting for us in the here and now, which is, because you will never get there, quote unquote, if you do not get there here, right? And the same in Christianity. You can find people who may be especially inspired to tend to the suffering of others in this world and seeing Jesus suffering the cross in the form of the suffering of those people. There are different ways of thinking about that, but you will find also many Christian mystics who are passionately in love with God and expressing deep attraction to the divine and willingness of service, which is not an opposite thing to the other thing, right? So that's also for me an important thing. It's not either or, no? It's not like, okay, do you choose to serve God and love God passionately, or do you choose to identify with the suffering of the world? Why we have to put that in as a dualistic question? That's an important point. No? And that's in the scriptures. The devotee who loves God in one tradition or any other, in our tradition, will define that person is full of mercy and full of compassion. So one thing allows the other. No? It's not like, but at the same time, we'll find examples like the ones you referred to, Vasudev Datta. There may be devotees who are specially inspired to offer themselves in service in certain unique way that you may not hear everyone else praying in the same way. And that's okay. It's not that there's only way of being a devotee, a lover of God, a Gaudiya Vaishnava, a Christian, and anything. No, because sometimes we tend, and I'm not saying you are doing that, but we tend to be reductionistic, right? Okay, every devotee should feel this. Every devotee should express their devotion this way. Every devotee should eventually fall into this box. And if you're a Christian, you should be like that. Of course, there are general ideas for all. Yeah, you are all supposed to grow into compassion and generosity and love and empathy and this and that. But the specifics of that will vary from one case to another, right? So Vasudev Datta will say that. Vasudev Datta is Prahlad Maharaj appearing in Gaur Lila. And Prahlad Maharaj himself is praying, like, I don't want to be liberated leaving all these people behind me. And then as Vasudev Datta, he's saying, give me all the karma from the entire universe and take them all, and I stay here by myself. But not necessarily every other Gaudiya Vaishnava will say the exact same thing. And it's okay. It's not that one is better than the other. Each soul will be inspired to offer themselves in service in different ways. So, but also I understand that, and we've talked about that many times. In our tradition, sometimes, again, as I said before, the idea of divine love is conceived as going somewhere else, like a geographic movement to some other planet. And that's not correct. Golok Vrindavan is a planet. I'm not against that idea. But what is that planet made of? Right? It's a planet made of consciousness. It's a planet made of faith, in Srila Siddhartha Maharaj's words. It's a planet made of bhava. or emotions, ecstasy. It's difficult for us to think probably now of a planet that is not made of the solid elements we know planets are made of, right? But so my point is, you reach that planet internally in terms of traveling in terms of consciousness. It's not that you take a mothership that takes you that far in kilometers and miles and you are there. Sometimes some expressions of that are made in our tradition to give us an idea. You have to resort to language and give some notion. Okay, that you pierce this layer and you go up and further up and further up, and there you have it, Golok Vrindavan. It's a way of articulating the actual inner topography of the soul. And you can reach there in terms of consciousness. And as we say, someone who really is a lover of God, that person is already there. So you don't need to arrive anywhere else. And depending where you are, in which stage of development of love, as I say, sometimes you may be very much... This will be a difference, I will say, in between Christianity and Gaudiya Vaishnavism on some degree, which is, and I'm not saying this makes one tradition better than the other, so we develop some superiority complex, but in Gaudiya Vaishnavism, there is a very clear depiction of the afterlife. There's a very detailed notion of what we are invited to do in eternity, which is not in Christianity, to be honest. And again, that's a tricky thing, because you could feel not quickly very superior because, oh, we know all these details, Krishna's Ashtakalya Lila, Mahaprabhu's Ashtakalya Lila, what do they do on the eight parts of the day, which are their services that they are doing, offering to them, and we can offer, and this and that. And in Christianity in general, the whole idea of what's happening after this life is how to say, is covered in a hell of mystery, which I wouldn't say is that a bad thing. As I mentioned once, I remember talking to a friend of mine and of some of us. He's a very nice Christian practitioner and author. And I asked him, like, really, what's your idea of what's going on after you die? As a Christian, what's your idea of the afterlife? You have any idea to begin with? I don't want to make an assumption. You have an idea? And he's told me, to be honest, I don't know. But I'm okay. He said, I'm okay with that being a mystery. I trust enough what I've experienced so far here to trust that whatever comes after that will be a very beautiful unfolding of it. So while that may not be our particular tradition, I can appreciate their willingness to coexist with such a mystery. Because for most of us, what's going on after death, that's a big mystery. And that can be very unsettling if you don't know with certainty what's going on. So many times we grab onto this detailed information of the afterlife so we don't have to deal with the uncertainty of what's happening after death. And I'm not saying those depictions are false. I'm just saying from which place we are embracing those depictions ourselves. As something that we are cherishing and longing for in the here and now, or as the perfect excuse of not to deal with uncertainty and the mystery of things. Because there's so much mystery. There's so much mystery, not what to speak of the afterlife. There's so much mystery right here, right now. In the very place and moment you are now, there are so many things that escape our control, our understanding. And many times we don't want to go there because it's unsettling. But to speak with all the bodily faculties start to collapse and you're invited to leave your body, that's pretty mysterious in one way. And it's okay. All right. So these are some thoughts. But again, I will personally say that as Gaudiya Vaishnavas, we should exercise compassion. This one last point I want to mention, which is that in other traditions, probably, again, connected to this idea of not having a very detailed depiction of the daily life of God and the emotional landscape of the divine in transcendence, suffering, we may identify with the suffering of people in this world, which is great, which is a great quality, empathy, compassion. I mean, we are not downplaying that. But we may also miss the mark that there are other forms of suffering. And I know that for some of us, some of this will be too much for us now. For example, the suffering that comes in love, in the union and separation of Radha and Krishna on a daily basis. There's so much suffering there. There are no conditioned souls there, but everyone is suffering so much in a very different way. And someone needs to tend to that suffering. In one sense, the suffering that comes out of pure love, and I again try to follow my line of thought, hopefully I'm making myself clear enough, that suffering is requires even more tending in one sense. I don't want to downplay the suffering of this world because we are also suffering. No, it's not that we are free from that. Others are suffering, and there's a huge, necessary, beautiful place to be there for the other, with empathy, with compassion, with affection, grieving together, accompanying each other in the journey. So much beauty in all that. But we should be very careful not to over-absolutize that suffering as the only way of service. Again, in Christianity, generally, service to God is expressed through service to other people, and many times, especially through service to those who are in need and those who are in suffering. In Gaudiya Vaishnavism, sometimes because of there being a more detailed idea of who God is and the daily life of God and what's in the afterlife, the notion of serving God ideally includes tending to people suffering in the world, but also extends to tending to God's own suffering, other suffering, connection to divine love. And again, I'm not saying there are no Christians exploring those depths as well. So these are different forms of suffering. Some thoughts that are coming. I don't know, Sveta Dubravka, what do you think so far? Come close to the screen again. Maybe there's something you would like to add.
Yeah, I mean, I really like everything you said. And yeah, one thing I was thinking about, the mystery bit, it's kind of, I mean, yeah, they don't know what is there after life. And in our tradition, it's given. And there is this risk of understanding all of that with our limited senses based on what we know now. So in a way, misunderstanding, even though all of that is given. And like, it's anyway mystery, like, you know, our life, we don't know what's going to happen next minute. So yeah, I appreciate that. And also, yeah, it does make sense, like, you know, why there's different kind of suffering that's coming out of love and all that in the spiritual world. And then I thought, okay, this now leaves me with the question, not me in general, me alone, but maybe a general question. Why is there suffering? You know, like there's a deeper purpose to that, which may be a topic for a full class in itself. So, yeah, I'm not asking you this question. No, I'm just saying, you know, just leaving with the question.
Yeah. Well, the question is why shouldn't there be suffering?
Yeah.
Because if we ask why is there suffering, it kind of has the assumption that suffering is something bad.
Yeah.
Suffering is something that ideally should not exist at certain point in certain place. So in that sense, that misses the whole point of what of the necessary role of suffering, always, everywhere. As again, opening our hearts and so on, and suffering coming out of love, grieving coming out of love, all that being an expression of love, a symptom of love. It's not, it doesn't have its separate existence, divorced from love, right? And of course, just to do justice to what I just said, in Christianity, there is some brief depiction of the afterlife. And Jesus, the word that he uses always to depict that is a banquet, right? That of a feast. Which in itself is very suggestive, very interesting, even if there's nothing else to say. That's basically what he said was waiting on the other side. No. Banquet, feast, abundance of gifts, abundance of grace. But again, I think it's a healthy way of leaving some dose of uncertainty that will be discovered only when we get there. So that creates the necessary impetus to get there. No, like many times, even some devotees, as we know, ask Srila Prabhupada like two detailed questions about the dynamics of the spiritual world, right? Like, do people go to the toilet in Golok Vrindavan? They will ask questions like that to him. Funny, right? And he will say, why don't you go there and find it for yourself? That would be his answer. Like, go get there and then you will know. In other words, even if I tell you yes, there is toilets, no, there are no toilets, what difference does it make? From which place is the question coming? Right? So at one point, all that information, even if there will be a verse, which I don't think there is, about toilets in the spiritual world, what do you do with that information? I mean, because if you don't do anything, it's just information. There has to be transformation. So we need to, again, get into the spiritual world as a movement in consciousness, and we get there eventually, internally. And when you are there, you know what it is, what is what. And even if some things remain a mystery, there will always some so many things that will remain a mystery. Even if you are officially an inhabitant of Golok Vrindavan, still there is so much mystery to it. So I think it's a sobering note to insist on that, on the dangers of toxic certainty and love in faith, the faith journey being a journey of patience, having patience with mystery while trusting, waiting for mystery to continue unfolding, an ever-evolving mystery, waiting while trusting the unfolding. Yeah. Anyhow, thank you. Thank you for your question. And we'll skip the break of the rooms in this one, since there are still more raised hands. Still there's raised hands from the group downstairs, but I'd like to give a space to Rosangi. Her hand is raised for a long time.
I'm getting
So
tired.
you must be tired at this point.
I'm tired.
Give a massage to your arm. Be relaxed. Like when Krishna was raising Govardhan and his friends came and said, you must be tired, and they start to massage the arm.
I was thinking like that. I'm feeling a little jealous. They're with you night and day for 12 days.
It's very simple how you can avoid being jealous. You buy a ticket to the UK and next time you come. That's very simple.
Or
That's what I
wherever.
do. That's what I did. I was born in Argentina, and I'm in England now. I'm even farther from England than you.
Yeah, I know, I know. I'm getting there, I'm getting there.
We'll meet in 3D soon, somehow or other.
We have to come to California or go to Hawaii. Let's do something. Anyway, I just wanted to give you some reflections. I don't have a lot of people here to give reflections to on these things. And so I wanted to, like, I'm stuck on chapter two. I'm
What are you
still,
talking? What book do you have in your hand? Okay. I didn't see. Sorry.
this is what I'm absorbed in now. And I'm fixated on chapter two, Maharaj. And
Can God be updated?
I was asking myself, what are the implications of this? What's the real importance of understanding that God is changeable, that he is love and not loving, and that the nature of love. And what I've been realizing is that as I dive in and enter into these very, really profound concepts and points and qualities of the sweet absolute that you're talking about, what it is like an opportunity to get to know him. And you know, there's a song, an old song, to know him is to love him. Well, that's an old song from when I was young. And I'm getting the point that he's pleased when we want to know him. And you're giving us an opportunity in this book to really get to know him so much better. And I'm so appreciative. You have no idea. Because it's breaking down the old rigid thinking. Like even what you were saying about one of the reasons that God is changeable is because he is love and he's not loving. There's no other option. He's love. And love unfolds and is changing, ever changing. So that is one of the reasons that points to God's changeability. I mean, there's so many brilliant points in here, and I'd like to have a book club to really dive in and discuss this at some point.
What's a book club?
Oh, where we read every week and discuss.
Oh, like a reading group.
A reading group.
Okay, I didn't know they call it book club. Sounds cool. Okay.
So your pauses are also giving me, I mean, they're brilliant as well, because they're giving pause and moments to really ponder and think, and then breakthroughs happen, and then energy shifts. I'm just so appreciative, as you can tell, and I'm still figuring out Krishna and chapter 2. I can't get beyond it because it's so rich and so full with very intricate and deep concepts.
Just in case it helps you, Rasayan, Krishna is not figurable. So you can let go of that attempt.
I know. But I know I can't figure out, but I can break out of my own rigidity and open up to what he is, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Breaking out of my own rigid old bonsai concepts so that I can experience more of that ever-changing, eternal, you know, beingness. Godding, as the Jews call it, Godding. Godding. You put it in your book. Godding, I love that. My question, Maharaj, I have so many questions, as you can tell, but
I don't believe you.
We're talking about pride. So, I love my people, my sweet people there. You know, pride, listen.
Look, you have your own fans club there. You see how they're printing.
They have my heart too.
They never did that to me during all these days in the retreat. And you can see how easily they are after you. Now I'm jealous. You were jealous of me being here and jealous of...
we've been texting. I said, give me a crumb. Give me a little something. Send me some crumbs. Sam has been so kind. Anuradha, I feel connected somehow or other. My question is, though, about pride. Maharaj, I understand pride goeth before the fall, that Krishna left the gopis because of pride, but we need to have a sense of pride, a healthy sense of pride, because we want to feel good about our accomplishments. We want to feel good about our family, our people, pride in her for doing that and this and that. So that pride is not such an awful thing, but when it's superior to others, and that's when it's a problem. But my being proud of myself for an accomplishment, because a lot of us feel like we should not like ourselves and not be proud of ourselves, and that doesn't feel healthy either. So being proud, I did that task today. I feel good about myself. It's a good thing. But what? But when I'm thinking I'm better than you or you and you because of that, that's the problem. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the gopis, not because they felt they were so happy, they're chosen by Krishna, they feel so loved, they feel great. But it's why? Because they felt better than everybody else? That Krishna didn't like that?
Yeah, I'd like to thank you. Thank you. Yeah, with the gopis, of course, different ways of explaining that, because we are talking about very high beings here. Gopis are not ordinary. They are in Rasa Lila with Krishna. You cannot get there casually. So one way that is the main point for me that is trying to be made in that section is that they kind of took the whole experience for granted in one level. They fell, and not like a mistake, like that's wrong, just a teaching for us mostly. Like they're articulating that you are dancing, celebrating with Krishna, and at one point you think, okay, we got him. We understand him. We are here. Some form of certainty, again, going back to certainty. And Krishna says, I'm out of here. This starts to feel boring. Too much certainty, too much taken for granted things. It's boring. It's not awesome. It's not wonderful. It's not exciting, surprising, unpredictable. It starts to feel suffocating, Krishna says. I need to run away from here to add some new dynamics and take the Rasa Lila to another level. And somehow this is connected with the idea of arrogance, or you say pride. Again, these are words. But for example, in our tradition, we have this word pratishta. Now, we have talked about that in the past. Pratishta sometimes is translated as the desire for position, fame, name, with maybe tied to the idea of pride. I just briefly mentioned something in this connection. Because actually, pratishta means pratishta. Shta means fixed, something fixed, like nishta, pratishta. And prati means at every moment. So pratishta means to expect things to be fixed and be in a certain way at every moment. That's pratishta. Like attachment to predictability, attachment to certainty. Sometimes it's translated as wanting fame and name, and it's also part of that, wanting fame and name, because that gives you some stability and sense of identity and security. But again, behind the wanting name and fame is this, no, the trying to validate yourself by position and name and fame, which gives you a certain sense of security and stability. Well, while love is about breaking all those boxes. So that in connection to certainty, taking things for granted, gopis, rasa lila. But regards to your main question, I will say feeling proud by attainments and things you may have done. I can understand how we may, the word pride and many other words, by the way, in the glossary or in the Gaudiya Vaishnav community have been deeply stigmatized, demonized, weaponized. So we may need to A, stop using them altogether and give them a break for a few decades so they recover their original meaning, or redefine them in a more healthy way, in a more encompassing way, or understanding them in other ways. So is it okay? Is it correct? Is it legal? Is it bona fide? Is it devotional to feel pride in any way? Is there a place for that? I don't know. I've done personally, and this is my personal take. Again, there's place for personal take, and there's place for you disagreeing with me. Just in case, you can disagree with Swamis also. They won't send you. They won't curse you and send you to hell by doing that. I think that, of course, as you mentioned, in a very correct way, Rasangi. Okay, if pride takes me to feel myself superior to others, that's not healthy, right? Now, if pride has to do with acknowledging some attainment, some accomplishment, to build a healthy sense of healthy self-image, so I don't feel miserable about myself and I'm useless and I cannot do anything in the name of humility, all that, right? So because we have a toxic sense of humility, many times that's tied to a toxic idea of pride as its opposite, and everything ends up being toxic. So I don't know if to use the word pride, because also another thing with pride will be, okay, I acknowledge something, I don't know, and let's speak for myself. Okay, I've written a book, my book, and Rasangi loves my book. Unless she's lying here in front of all of us, which I hope she doesn't. No, I trust you. So I can feel, oh, I'm proud that someone like Rasangi likes my book. But I wouldn't use the word proud, to be honest. I'll say I feel happy, and I feel fortunate, and I feel blessed, and I feel content that I was able to write the book. But also because something with pride in acknowledging pride in my own accomplishments, in some cases, could be that whatever we accomplish, and again, I don't want to go to an area, to a toxic sense of you didn't do anything ever, be humble. No, I'm not saying that. But whenever we accomplish something, also we are not isolated beings. So whatever we accomplish, not it's never just ourselves accomplishing that. So if pride takes me to take all the credit for myself, even if I'm not putting anyone else down, but I may be putting myself too much up. And like Krishna says in the Gita, in every action, there are so many factors operating at the same time. God's grace, well-wishers in my life, people influencing me. So, okay, I've written my book, but so many people inspired and nourished my journey. And because of that, I'm writing my book. I have something to say. I have some inspiration to share with others. I have the strength to I don't know, whatever it may be, the willingness to go through the hard process of writing a book, which is a whole labor pain in itself, so to say. And I'm doing my part, of course. I have to do my part. Nobody else can do that. That's why my name is in the book as the author. But I've always struggled, and I say that many times. And I try to clarify that in the acknowledgement section. Thank God there is something called acknowledgement section in a book, which is basically for me, the acknowledgement section is like a way of saying, actually, I'm not the author of the book, only myself. Somehow I had to put my name in the cover, but there's all these people, long list, all the circumstances, even not even people, but life situations and that have been instrumental in that. So my point is, bringing all that into the picture, I personally don't feel like being proud in my accomplishment, like something only I did. So because if that's the case, that will be a problem, because we are isolating ourselves. It's a self-alienation process, pride. I did it. There's nobody else that can take credit for this one. I did it. The whole thing is, why do you even need to take it that way, right? And probably many times it's paradoxical, but many times we embrace that form of pride because we are very insecure in ourselves. So we need to take all the credit possible. So somehow we are someone. We did something. We develop a sense of identity that is all about us. Because if that wouldn't be the case, if I have to share the credit with others, I start to feel insecure about myself. I start to feel that I'm not so much. So, but if we have a healthy self-image, I don't need to be the sole protagonist of any act, just myself. I'm okay understanding everything is co-creation. In everything, there is an inspiration coming from so many sources. So in that sense, I personally, and again, I don't mean to say you shouldn't use the word pride either, but for me personally, yeah, I don't feel the need to say it. I'm proud of that, no? Again, and I'm not saying you cannot say that. Sometimes I heard about saying, I'm humbly proud. Actually, I say that sometimes, but mostly in relation to other people. Like, I don't know, if I see someone I love and they are growing and blossoming and being a very beautiful example too, it's like, I'm humbly proud of who you are becoming, so to say. So it may be a different way of using the word pride. So again, it's a word, only it's a word. It's just a few letters put together, P-R-I-D-E. So So what's behind that? That's for me the real thing, right? Yeah.
It's true, Maharaj. And the idea is that we are co-creating, but that's also exciting to be able to be gifted the ability to co-create things. It's very exhilarating. There's wonderful energy there.
Yeah.
But you're saying that.
But again, you say the ability of being gifted. So gifted entails a gift. many times that gift is being bestowed upon us. Not again to feel bad about ourselves, but just to be deeply humbled of who we happen to be. Because at the end of the day, let's be honest, as much as I, and we do things and we attain things, we are not our own creation. So I am what I am, which happens to be something wonderful. And that's not me saying that. That's why we would get it to 29, just in case. Don't burn me at the stake. No?
Oh.
And that's only me. It's each one of you. Krishna says you are wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. But I have not crafted that wonderfulness. I just happen to be wonderful. Which is not like a casual thing. I happen to be wonderful. It's what it is, and it's great and beautiful, and we should explore that. But we shouldn't become proud of that, right? I can't be proud of me being amazing as a soul, because I did not create that. And actually, I lived a long time very much unaware of that what I am. So all the more, I don't have any reasons to be proud. But I have all reasons to be humbled. But again, understanding that humility is not a degrading thing. So sometimes also we may, and I'm not saying that's your case, but sometimes I see people trying to emphasize pride, but many times because they have not found a dignifying definition of humility. The only idea of humility they found is degrading, not very uplifting. So I can understand if that's the case, I don't want to be humble, because humble means to be low, to be worse than everyone else, to feel miserable about myself. Let's cultivate pride somehow. But there is a very healthy side to humility, right? And it's very humbling and it's beautiful. And as we were talking these days, Krishna himself leads the way in terms of humility. He has so many reasons to be proud, right? About who he is, but he's not. He feels indebted by this very smallest gesture of love from his devotee. He feels so empathic with the suffering of every living being. He feels grateful in advance for the service that we have not yet offered to him. There are all these beautiful statements, scripture. So he's not feeling proud. He's not saying, I'm such a great guy. I'm the all attractive, by the way, guys. I don't know if you have heard that. My name is Krishna, so to say. And I have accomplished this or that. Again, when we hear that someone like Mahaprabhu is like, wow, we could say that's Krishna 2.0, the final, the ultimate version of the divine. And he's very humbly saying, I have no love. But he's full of it. So there's this paradoxical humility. Of course, then on another, again, there's so much to say, but on another dimension, you have Sri Radha, a caressing man, which is this loving peak, you say in English, right? Which includes a form of pride. But it's a pride that she enters into that mood because she knows that gives Krishna's pleasure. So it's not pride about herself, but just resorting to pride as a means to create pleasure in her beloved. So it's a very different way of speaking about pride, right? Of playing stubborn and being in denial, not being open easily to Krishna, playing it difficult, but all that because she knows this gives Krishna so much pleasure. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I agree that there is a place in a healthy way to be, let's say, to be able to acknowledge in a healthy way things that have come to your life and that you have played part in that role. Again, it's not to the point of You have done everything yourself. No, you needed help. You didn't need help from anyone. It's all your credit, 108%. That's too much. But also it's not 0%, right? No, you didn't do anything. Krishna is doing everything. We are just whatever. Now, sometimes we go into this predeterministic pattern where you no longer have free will, basically. And that's another extreme, another side of the same toxic coin. So trying to find the middle point. I have a role to play. I have free will. I can make my contribution. I have energy, qualities, gifts to offer, and only I can actualize them. But even if I do that in a beautiful way, still there are so many other elements at play that I have to recognize and give due credit to. So everything is an ongoing process of co-creation, which is, again, it's humbling, it's beautiful, it's relational, it's collaborative, it's family working together, it's always teamwork. It's not me on the top of the mountain doing the whole thing myself in a bubble, isolated, alienated. That's a problem. So whether you want to use the word pride or any other thing, that's secondary for me. As long as we're, yeah, doing it from the right place. Yeah. Okay. Let's go to one more breakthrough room. And if there is one more question, maybe we have space for that after, and we may do it one last before we conclude. Breakthrough, breakout rooms for a few minutes, again, 6 minutes. Sharing some thoughts about this notion of pride, these different ways of expressing and acknowledging, and whatever comes to our lives. Continue churning the ocean, please. Welcome back again. We are almost on time, but I don't know if there is anything else to share. I remember there was some digital hand from the room below, if I'm not mistaken, or I did misread the room. I misread the room. Okay.
Divyangana had her hand raised. There's no one else here with a question.
But she's not connected.
Yeah, Abhinandan, I think, is also not here.
But she's not connected either. Yeah. I'm sorry we didn't have the time to address that. Okay. Badra is raising her hand. From New Zealand. Let's conclude with her offering today.
Thank you, Maharaj. I just thought I'd be an opportunist and raise my hand since no one else was. You were talking about earlier, we were discussing charity and the Christian concept of giving to the poor, especially underprivileged people. And in the first few years of devotional life, the way that it was presented, the way I experienced it, there was the idea that to give to like street beggars and things like that was not really Vaishnava practice, because the real charity is to give them the holy name and or give them a book or something. And but in recent years, I've felt compassion for when I see people, and we see them in New Zealand, people sitting on the side of the road with a little sign saying, I'm hungry, or, you know, please help. These days, I give them some money. I give them $5 or something like that. And I usually say to them, I don't know whether this is conditional or what, but I usually say to them, please do not buy a drug for cigarettes, but please spend it on food. And that they usually look at me with such gratitude and promise that they'll only buy food, but whatever, once it's theirs, they can do what they like with it, I guess. But I was mentioning this to a devotee, a sadhaka of many years. In fact, I've known this person since day one in aspiring bhakti. And he said, that's charity in the mode of ignorance. So I just like your comment on that, Maharaj, please.
It's interesting because I was thinking about when you started speaking about charity, and I addressed that in my fourth book, which is of course not published, but I've been writing it, and we're talking the whole main theme of the book is unconditional love, right? And one of the qualities of unconditional love is that you are being loved without condition. We are being loved not because you earn it, because you deserve it, but it's being given to anyone in any moment and in any place. And Sri in Bhagavad Gita, charity in the mode of ignorance is described as giving something without consideration of the proper place and qualification of the person. So I'm presenting an argument to myself in the book, like saying, okay, so does it mean that God's unconditional love to us is charity in the mode of ignorance, right? Does it mean that Mahaprabhu's and Nityananda Prabhu's utter Audharya Lila, utter generosity, indiscriminate sharing is charity in the mode of ignorance, because they're not considering place, circumstance, qualification, anything. They're just spreading the whole thing, which of course is not charity in the mode of ignorance, right? There's no mode of ignorance in Mahaprabhu, in Bhagavan. So I would say that when, and I assume, I don't know, of course, this person you are referring to, and much less I know from which place he or she said he say what what he said. But when he say, oh, that's charity in the mode of ignorance, I think probably it's based on this line of the Gita, giving something to someone without consideration of place and circumstance. I wouldn't say that's, I wouldn't agree necessarily with his view on your giving charity. But of course, I can get the point. And it's tricky, as you mentioned, because someone is, okay, I'm hungry. And of course, you can give them food if you're hungry, and hopefully they can honor it, prasad. If you give them money, as you say, it's dangerous because you don't know if they will end up buying food or buying heroin and killing themselves. And of course, again, I trust your heart and giving that and lovingly forcing them to promise you that they will actually buy food. But the whole spirit of that charity in the mode of ignorance is basically don't give something to someone which will end up causing more harm than relief, right? Even if it comes from a good heart, it will be something like one of the 10 offenses of the name. Don't preach to those devoid of faith, right? Don't give them something that they are not ready to receive. The result may be they will become more averse, not more in denial. Or different ways of speaking about the same thing. No, don't speak about something, I don't know, too high or too confidential. If in terms of spiritual topics, Harikatha, if the audience is not ready to understand and process that, then will clearly misread that and do violence to themselves. Can happen. Even if the intention was not bad, it can happen. And if it happens, we can always, of course, do something to heal that and continue the journey. It's not that, oh, it happened, there's no way back, the end of the story. But I personally think there is place to, and I also, of course, heard that the only charity or the topmost charity is to give the holy name or to give a book. I've heard that many times. I've said that many times in my young Brahmachari book distributor years. I own it. Not to an extreme, to be honest, but it was part of the narrative, right? So you inherit the narrative. At one point, you just go along with it. And you do it with a good heart. Again, you really want to, you are convinced that that's the best for them, and you want to give that to them. Like we were talking the other day about, I don't know, Christian campaigns of like the Crusades or the quote unquote Holy Inquisition, which of course were disastrous in so many ways, but many of those Christians were really convinced these native people, these pagans, are going to hell, and we want to save them. And we, the way to save them is to make them convert to Christianity. That was their conception, but they really wanted to save them from hell. But it was in ignorance because they didn't realize that they were not going to hell. And many of them were closer to the divine than than the ones who were trying to convert them. Again, there was good intention, but there was ignorance covering that. So that it doesn't that you are influenced by Tamaguna doesn't mean that you have a bad intention. You can have a very good intention, a very good heart, and being covered by ignorance. So there is a place, like a case to make about, as they say, now the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Like implying, I mean, it's great to have good intentions. Let's begin there, and then let's with proper knowledge, let's refine the expressions of our good intentions. So, but again, it's interesting because sometimes we say, okay, charity in ignorance means giving something to someone without knowing the particularities of time, place, circumstance, and qualification. But on the other time, on the other side, someone would say, so that's in the mode of ignorance. Real charity is to give a book to everyone. But not everyone is ready to receive a book. So if you push on the just give the book, just make them chant the mantra, that may be charity in the mode of ignorance. Because you are not considering what's the situation of that person, especially if someone is in the street saying, I'm hungry. And you would like them so badly to study Bhagavatam, but they are starving first. So being sensitive to time, place, and circumstances, and because you want so badly for them to enjoy Bhagavatam, first I will give them a very nice sandwich. So they stop starving. And then we can talk about some other things. And again, at the same time, also, of course, this is another point. Giving helping someone even by giving some food, it shouldn't be with the idea of, with the expectation, I only do this so I can finally speak the Bhagavatam to you. No? My giving you a sandwich is just a bridge. Actually, I don't care about that. I only want you to read the Bhagavatam. If you don't, are not willing to read the Bhagavatam, I stop giving you sandwiches. That shouldn't be the case either, right? Because behind all of this, and I again, I'm trying to own it myself. Certain stage of my journey, yeah, as a preacher, which is a word I no longer like to use. To define myself, when people tell me you're a preacher, it's like, no. I'm not a preacher. I don't like to identify myself as such. But at one point, that was my worldview. And I was out there in the streets trying to save the world while I was far from being saved myself. And I was with this idea of, okay, you know all this, right? If they just touch the book and give the book or something, they're on their way. And I would like everyone to know Bhagavad Gita, and I really it was with good intention, but it was not refined enough because looking back now, I was okay, there was lots of insecurity still in me in terms, and what do I mean by this? I wanted everyone to be doing what I was doing, let everyone chant the Mahamantra, let everyone study Bhagavatam. I need that to happen so they somehow validate what I'm doing myself. Because if I remain being just a part of a religious minority, probably I'm still not so sure if I'm doing the right thing. Again, all this unconsciously, but some degree of that maybe was there. And in time, hopefully, you grow to be okay with I'm choosing this tradition, I'm happy, and I'm choosing for these reasons, and I don't need to convert anyone to see the to take over the world. I don't need any of that to happen. And I can show compassion and love to anyone, even without giving a book, even without making them say Krishna, right? Tricking them into saying Krishna or whatever, giving a donation. At the end of the day, at least for me in this stage of my journey, and I'm not saying it's any final stage or anything like that, but I'm pretty convinced that. And I'm open to change my mind, but that's where I am now. that the best thing you can give someone, whatever the form it takes, it's a sandwich, it's a book, it's maha mantras, but you have to give them an experience of unconditional love. An experience, because that's what everyone is looking for, ultimately, what everyone needs, including us. That's what we are needing and what many times we are lacking. As we're sharing today, a quote from Henry Nouwen, he said, "What suffering? Suffering is the experience of not receiving what you need the most." That's suffering. The experience of not receiving what you need the most. And what you need the most is love. All you need is love, unconditional love. So giving them that experience by listening to them, by seeing them, by making them feel seen, as we're talking these days, feel held, feel loved. That can be life transforming. Whether a book is attached to that, a maha mantra card is attached to that, the prasad sandwich is attached to that, that's totally secondary, at least for me. But if you give them a moment of genuine presence and empathy and attention and awareness and kindness, really, truly, and the other person is open to that, they will never forget that. And that will be real charity, real gift, real charity. It's not measured by externals, but the depth of how deep you can touch the other person's heart. And that's for me real charity. I mean, whether the book is there or not, the number of books doesn't amount to success for me, but the amount of transformed hearts. And for that, our own heart has to be transformed. It's not enough to become a professional bookseller and learn tactics and strategies and know how to slip the book and get an extra donation and cheat the people with the change with the money and get. That's not very interesting for me. That doesn't require that you learn to love someone unconditionally. That takes another work, and that's the work we need to embrace and the gift we need to extend to others. So my point with all this is, if you are giving that person in the street that says, "I'm hungry," of course we know they're hungry for food, and beyond that, they're hungry for something else, though even they may not know it. And hopefully we can help them to contact their deeper hunger. But first, we may need to attend their immediate hunger, physically, biologically. Again, like someone is drowning on an ocean, you have first to jump and save them, and then we can have a conversation about another topics. I cannot tell you drowning like, "Chant Hare Krishna before you get drowned." No, save me. Then we can chant Hare Krishna a few times, right? A few more times. So I wouldn't say that the charity you have shown to that person is necessarily in the mode of ignorance. Again, it has a lot to do with the motivation, right? Because maybe many times we may give charity to someone, and I'm not saying again, this is your case, of course, but we can give charity to someone and feel superior to just perpetrate this superiority complex. Like, "I'm helping you. You depend on me. I'm giving charity. You are receiving charity from me." So you are reinforcing these two parties, two sides, instead of we are all one. And by me giving to you, you are giving me the chance of giving to you. So I'm receiving from you. But many times in giving charity, we can be perpetrating going back to pride, right? This sense of separate accomplishment and doership. "Ah, I'm helping all these people so much. I'm such a good person. They depend on me. What will they do in their life if it were not for me feeding them on the daily basis?" So those things can happen. And externally, it's officially charity. But what's going on inside? How much w I am making an effort to give? Because again, let's say I'm multimillionaire and I'm walking and I give someone $100. And for them, it's like, "Wow, this is a month's salary for me." But for me, it's nothing. And I'm not condemning that. But my point is, that's not the all in all in terms of charity. Ultimately, charity has to take you to the edges of your capacities to love unconditionally. It may begin with a sandwich. It's totally fine. It may begin with a blanket. So many things that may be required, but from which place that's coming. Not just to feel I'm checking the boxes, I'm a good boy, I'm a good girl. Nobody can tell me anything. I'm giving the sandwich and the blankets. I'm nice. Don't invite me to love unconditionally. I'm giving my blanket. It's great. We have to begin somewhere. For some, even giving a blanket is the first step in unconditional love. But we have to, yeah, we should be careful not to stop and not become complacent again, fall into a place of toxic certainty in the name of charity. So it's all about what's going on in the inner landscape, from which place I'm doing that, what's the fruit of that. Yeah. I don't know if that helps. It helped me.
Very much, Maharaj. Thank you. Beautiful answer. Thank you.
Thank you for the question. It has helped me, so thank you. Okay, before putting our discussion to rest till next week, let's go one more time, last time, a few more minutes sharing breakout, breakthrough rooms, notions of charity, different ways of helping, extending unconditional love and whatnot. So see you back in 6 minutes or so for our final farewell.